Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the March edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. I want to start with the discussion page regarding the January-February edition of the Smithsonian. From the editors, the global war on terrorism, the focus of our January-February issue, struck a chord with veterans like Jerry R. Miller of Los Angeles. This is a treasure I would have asked to be buried with if I had not already signed up for cremation. Alan Levy of Culver City, California said, "Your superb issue was a bitter reminder, as C.J. Chivers wrote, of what happens when a superpower misjudges its foes and then changes its mind." Gay McMillan in Austin, Texas promised to share the magazine so others can experience those powerful stories and see the images that capture war's truth. One reader wrote in to comment on canine veterans. "What a wonderful article. War dog. We tend to forget about these canine heroes after the wartime tours are over. Obviously, they too suffer from post-traumatic stress. I wonder how many other readers shed tears after reading this article." Another reader wrote in about the Forgotten War article. "I was aghast that A Nation at Arms did not mention the Korean War. Did some 40,000 casualties not happen? Please explain the omission." The editor's response, "Though the Nation at Arms illustration incorporated all the armed conflicts since 1776, we regret that we didn't provide a caption highlighting the Korean War." And lastly, a comment from the Epidemics Past and Present. "I want to thank Holly Malia for her great article about the movie Philadelphia, which was released around the time one of my best friends in high school died of AIDS. The article brought those memories back. Almost all of the extras in the movie who were HIV positive are now gone. While opioid drug abuse is a heartbreaking problem that may be causing as much death as AIDS, my generation will never forget losing people who were discriminated against because of a condition that no one deserved to die of." Now let's start today's program out of the prologue section. And the first article is written by Lorianne Ali, titled Plot Twist. Long before Daenerys Targaryen commanded her dragons to torch armies of White Walkers in Game of Thrones, another strong visionary woman sparked the revolution that makes today's epic entertainment so profitable, if not plausible. Erna Phillips, a screenwriter and radio actor, led the way with a bold innovation whose impact on world culture everyone underestimated. These Are My Children, the first daytime serial television drama, which she created 70 years ago. Phillips went on to turn her successful radio drama Guiding Light into a TV soap opera in 1952, and also launched As the World Turns, 1956, and Another World, 1964. Critics, of course, hated TV's newest dramas. Last week, television caught the dread disease of radio soap operatis, Pathfinder News magazine complained when These Are My Children debuted. Trade publication Variety found the show to be of no visual interest. But television soap operas, largely created by women for women, were soon attracting tens of millions of viewers and driving network revenue. Mid-century housewives had more free time to tune in than did previous generations of women, thanks partly to innovations such as the automatic dishwasher and clothes dryer. And marketers were keen to tap the buying power of this vast new demographic, as evidenced by the detergent ads that originally gave rise to the sudsy nickname in the 1930s. By 1970, the three major networks were airing a total of 18 daytime serials. Daytime soaps, televised 5 days a week and 52 weeks a year, were far less polished than primetime fare. Actors often ad-libbed and productions were rushed. Small, minimally lighted sets with lots of shadows created a stagey look that was surprisingly well-suited to the small black-and-white screen and heightened the melodramatic mood. Most significant, though, the storylines were open-ended and would stretch for weeks, months, even decades. War and Peace is a Day at the Beach compared with All My Children, which starred Susan Lucci as Erica Kane for 41 years, and One Life to Live featuring Erica Slezak as Victoria Lord for 42. And what stories! Cheating spouses, secret babies, evil twins, amnesia, ghost, time travel, and vampires, not to mention the horrors of raising teenagers. No matter how outrageous, the twisting plots were grounded in the great American post-war preoccupations of family and romance. And unlike the flawless housewives on primetime, the women on the soaps were allowed flawed marriages, rotten kids, and successful careers. In the fictional town of Port Charles, where General Hospital is set, both the police chief and the head cardiologist have been female. And shockingly, soaps featured women over 40 who didn't dress like Aunt B. There was a freedom in being dismissed as trite. The soaps slipped past the naysayers who ruled the evening lineup and eagerly tackled controversial topics. Another World dramatized a woman's decision to have an abortion in 1964, 9 years before the landmark decision of Roe v. Wade. One Life to Live featured interracial romances in 1968, and gay characters appeared on the show in 1992, 6 years before Will and Grace. In the 1990s, General Hospital confronted the reality that Americans were reluctant to deal with, HIV and AIDS. Soap operas were much more aggressive than they were given credit for in that era, says Tara McPherson, professor at the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts. I'm certain the first interracial kiss my grandmother ever saw in Baton Rouge was on a soap opera. Having characters coming into women's homes from a different world had consequences that were certainly more positive than negative. And yet, cue the organ music, not even a soap opera can last forever. Only four are being produced for daytime network TV today. Days of Our Lives, General Hospital, The Bold and the Beautiful, and The Young and the Restless. In 1981, General Hospital averaged about 14 million viewers, and an astounding 30 million tuned in to watch Luke and Laura's wedding. Now, the top-rated The Young and the Restless averages about 4 million. One reason for the decline is that, with more people working outside the home, fewer watch daytime TV. And they have infinitely more options, with cable channels galore, as well as DVRs and streaming services that make it possible to watch any of the primetime dramas that stole the soap opera's soul and then eloped with its fan base. It was the soap's character-driven, boundary-pushing, scripted serials that laid the foundation for today's critically acclaimed hits, from the dystopian drama The Handmaid's Tale to the spy thriller Killing Eve. It's impossible to imagine TV's golden age right now without the narrative structure that comes from soap operas, says McPherson. But after decades of looking down on daytime serials, actually admitting that prestige TV owes more to Susan Lucci than Shakespeare sounds as absurd as, well, a soap opera. There's an interesting sidebar article here titled Guiding Lights about how America's frothiest export has tackled weighty issues on TV and radio worldwide and improved people's lives. For instance, in the United Kingdom, there's a show titled The Archers. This everyday story of country folk was originally designed to teach modern farming methods. In Mexico, the show Come With Me was prominently about adult literacy. Enrollment in such classes jumped ninefold. In Sudan, Sails of Hope was about an AIDS focus. In Brazil, as a result of the show Brave Women, authorities rescued a victim of sex trafficking after her mother learned about the warning signs on this soap. South Africa, Soul City, a 1999 storyline about domestic violence, prompted 180,000 calls to an abuse prevention hotline. In Afghanistan, the show New Home, New Life, a story raising awareness of landmines, made listeners in affected areas half as likely to be hurt by one. In Kenya, the show Let's Discuss focused on family planning, coinciding with the falling fertility rates from 6.3 to 4.4 children. In Rwanda, the show New Dawn increased acceptance of marriage between Hutus and Tutsis after the genocide. In Pakistan, they had a show named Sammy, which tackled sex discrimination with storylines about honor killings, forced marriages, and denying women inheritances. The effects of this show are still being studied. And lastly, in India, the show Us. Family harmony and family planning were among the topics addressed. 400,000 viewers wrote to ask the star to promote love marriages over arranged ones. Moving on to our next article out of the prologue section, titled America's First Poster Child. In 1855, this girl energized the abolitionist movement. For the first time, we tell her story. written by Jesse Morgan Owens. On February 19, 1855, Charles Sumner, the Massachusetts senator, wrote his supporters about an enslaved 7-year-old girl whose freedom he had helped to secure. She would be joining him on stage at an abolitionist lecture that spring. "I think her presence among us in Boston will be a great deal more effective than any speech I could make," the noted orator wrote. He said her name was Mary, but he also referred to her, significantly, as another Ida May. Sumner enclosed a daguerreotype of Mary standing next to a small table with a notebook at her elbow. She is neatly outfitted in a plaid dress with a solemn expression on her face, and looks for all the world like a white girl from a well-to-do family. When the Boston Telegraph published Sumner's letter, it caused a sensation. Newspapers from Maine to Washington, D.C. picked up on the story of the white slave from Virginia. And paper copies of the daguerreotype were sold alongside a broadsheet promising the history of Ida May. The name referred to the title character of Ida May, the story of things actual and possible, a thrilling novel published just 3 months earlier about a white girl who was kidnapped on her 5th birthday, beaten unconscious, and sold across state lines into slavery. The author, Mary Hayden Greene Pike, was an abolitionist, and her tale was calculated to arouse white Northerners to oppose slavery and to resist the Fugitive Slave Act, the 5-year-old freedom law demanding that suspected slaves be returned to their masters. Pike's story fanned fears that the law threatened both black and white children who, once enslaved, might be difficult to legally recover. It was shrewd of Sumner to link the outrage stirred by the fictional Ida May to the plight of the real Mary, a brilliant piece of propaganda that turned Mary into America's first poster child. But Mary hadn't been kidnapped. She was born into slavery. I first learned of Mary in 2006, the same way the residents of Boston met her in 1855, by reading Sumner's letter. That chance encounter led me on a 12-year-long quest to discover the truth about this child who had been lost to history, a forgotten symbol of the nation's struggle against slavery. Now the true story of Mary Mildred Williams can be told in detail for the first time. In the reading room of the Massachusetts Historical Society, I held Mary's daguerreotype, labeled Unidentified Girl 1855. She would still be missing, but for a handwritten note offering a clue to her identity. Slave child in which Governor Andrew was interested. I went on to find the story of Mary and her family in thousands of documents spread across 115 years, beginning in the court filings and depositions of the Cornwalls, the Virginia family who had owned Mary's grandmother, Prudence Nelson Bell, since 1809. Prudence and her children were all so light as to be taken to be white, the courts stated. Their skin color was evidence of a then common act, non-consensual sex between an enslaved woman and a white member of the master's class. Mary's mother was Elizabeth, Prudence's daughter with her mistress's neighbor, Captain Thomas Nelson. Mary's father was Seth Botts, an enslaved man who was the son of his master. Elizabeth and Seth were married in the early 1840s. Mary, their second child, was born in 1847. In 1850, Mary's father escaped to Boston via the Underground Railroad, changing his name along the way to Henry Williams to match his forged free papers. Through his remarkable charisma, Williams raised enough funds to buy the freedom of his children, his wife, her mother, and 4 of Mary's aunts and uncles. Abolitionist John Albion Andrew, the future governor of Massachusetts, was Williams's lawyer, and he contacted Sumner to handle the funds needed to redeem Mary and her family from Virginia. Once freed, they traveled to Washington, where they met the senator. Sumner said the oldest Williams child, Oscar, was bright and intelligent, with the eyes of an eagle and a beautiful smile. But Sumner chose to photograph Mary and introduce her to journalists and Massachusetts legislators. Oscar was dark, like his father, while Mary was light, like her mother. Mary's whiteness made her compelling to white audiences. Throughout the spring of 1855, Mary made headlines in Washington, New York, and Massachusetts. In March, she sat on stage at Boston's Tremont Temple as Sumner lectured the crowd of thousands. and at least twice she appeared with Solomon Northup, a freeborn black man who had, in fact, been kidnapped and enslaved. He had told his story in the memoir, 12 Years a Slave. Little Ida May faded from view after the Civil War, but I was able to piece together the basic facts of her life. She never married and did not have children. She resided mostly in Boston near her family, working as a clerk in the Registry of Deeds and living as a white woman, a decision criminalized in the Jim Crow era as passing. The Reverend Thomas Wentworth Higginson, an abolitionist who knew her, said he willingly lost sight of her so she could disappear into the white ranks. Mary moved to New York City in the early years of the 20th century. She died in 1921, and her body was returned to Boston and buried with her family in an integrated cemetery. I never found a single letter or document written by Mary herself, and no contemporary quotations of hers survives. Her own voice remains unheard. In March 1855, young Mary was taken to the offices of the New York Daily Times, where reporters looked her over and expressed astonishment that this child was held a slave. Today, people are similarly surprised when I show them the daguerreotype of Mary and I point out she was born into slavery. They react the same as people did a century and a half ago, revealing that they still harbor some of the assumptions about race and slavery that Sumner tapped into when he first put Mary on stage. An article in Media titled Publish or Perish. Can an obscure 19th century literary form help correct Wikipedia's notorious gender bias? By Amy Crawford. With nearly 6 million articles in English alone, Wikipedia is the world's go-to resource for facts on topics from the arts to berserk llama syndrome. Still, there's one area where the crowd-surfaced reference falls short. The achievements of women, who make up less than 19% of Wikipedia's biographies. But there might just be a 19th century solution to this 21st century problem. Prosopography, now obscure collections of biographical sketches of prominent men and women. Wikipedia's gender imbalance reflects the site's contributors, who are about 90% male, but it is also a result of its notability standards, says Michelle Moravnik, a historian at Rosemont College. Under the rule, Wikipedia subjects need to have received significant coverage in published sources, historically a high bar for women. Notably, it is not a neutral concept, Moravnik says. Even physicist Donna Strickland was not notable enough for the online encyclopedia right up until she won the Nobel Prize in 2018. That's where prosopographies come in. The volumes are a citable source of information about accomplished women who might not otherwise meet the notability standard. Over the last 15 years, University of Virginia English professor Allison Booth has collected 1,272 prosopographies and assembled an online database of more than 7,500 women featured in their pages. It has served as a resource for thousands of Wikipedia pages about women such as Maria Gowan Brooks, whose poetry was praised by Edgar Allan Poe, and Alice Marvel, who qualified as a physician at the time when women were often barred from the profession. Booth's work also reveals how notability has changed. Famous beauties was once one of the biggest categories of notable women. And from Education, an article written by April Wright, titled Written Out of History. A new study reveals just how few women are required reading in America's schools. Education officials have a lot to learn about women, according to a new analysis of guidelines for teaching social studies in each of the 50 states and Washington, D.C. Poring over all those K-12 instruction standards, the National Women's History Museum found that only 178 of the historic figures listed were women. Or, Smithsonian calculates, one woman for every three men. Some of the disparity is that men have long dominated government. Even so, there are curious omissions. For instance, none of the guidelines explicitly calls for learning about Representative Jeanette Rankin of Montana, who in 1916 became the first woman elected to federal office. the gender gap. As of 2017, state and D.C. social studies standards, which set goals for each grade level, obliged K through 12 public schools to cover 737 historical figures, 559 men, and 178 women, including two fictional characters, Molly Pitcher and Rosie the Riveter. Each of these notable women is named in the instruction guidelines of just one state. Josephine Pearson, Tennessee, a leading voice against women's suffrage a century ago. She said the responsibility of voting would be a burden for women and a threat to the Southern way of life. Lizzie Johnson, Texas. The cattle queen of Texas found success among the cowboys in the 1870s. She owned a ranch, registered her own brand, and drove her longhorns against the Cholsum Trail. Biddy Mason, California. After suing for her freedom from slavery at the age of 38, Mason worked as a nurse, invested in land in the growing city of Los Angeles, and became a millionaire philanthropist. Marie Webster, Indiana. The turn of the century, Martha Stewart. Webster turned quilting into a thriving business. Her books and arts and crafts inspired quilt patterns made her a household name. Mary Leese, Kansas. In the 1890s, long before she had the right to vote, Leese was a nationally known political orator and a prominent, if divisive, leader in the Kansas People's Party. Luisa Capitillo, Washington, D.C., a Puerto Rican labor leader, the feminist writer of the early 20th century, Capitillo was also known for being arrested in Havana. Her crime? Wearing pants in public. Mary Fields, Washington, D.C. Stagecoach Mary was a Wild West legend, a formerly enslaved woman who carried the U.S. mail and her rifle through the rough-and-tumble Montana mountains in the 1890s. Emily Roebling. Roebling was instrumental in the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge in New York in the 1870s, stepping in as surrogate chief engineer after her husband fell ill. She later earned a law degree. And lastly, Anne Story from Vermont. When many settlers fled Vermont at the start of the Revolutionary War, Story and her children stayed. She provided the state militia with shelter and supplies and spied on the British. Here are the women most often cited in education standards. Rosa Parks, Susan B. Anthony, Harriet Tubman, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Sojourner Truth, Abigail Adams, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Jane Addams, Norma McCarvey, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Sacagawea. And out of the art section of the prologue, an article written by Amy Crawford, Veiled Meaning, An Artist Finds Joy in a Colorful Yet Complicated Symbol. Long before the 7th century Quranic edict that female believers not display their beauty, women across the world, among them Jews, Christian, and Hindus, wore veils to indicate religious devotion and privileged social status. Today the practice is politically fraught. Several Western European countries have instituted burqa bans, which prohibit face coverings, while in Iran, the hijab is mandated by law. For Muslim women in Lagos, Nigeria, however, a veil is not only a sign of faith, but a fashion statement. In the West, I think we've really developed a finite, limited view, when the practice is much more complex, says Medina Duggar, whose digital collage series, Enshroud, celebrates the veil's creative possibilities. The Texas-born photographer first visited Africa's largest metropolis in 2011 and found the fast-growing city's hectic pace and abundant creativity so appealing, she decided to stay. Lagosians' aesthetic originality serves as a refreshing counterexample to the globalization of fashion, Duggar says. It's also a reminder that the Islamic world is far from methodic, and just because a woman covers her head, it doesn't mean she's sacrificed her right to self-expression. Duggar makes a stylish statement by superimposing vibrant images of women jumping and twirling over photographs of patterned mats common in Nigeria. And we'll end today's program with Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. Question: Who was the first woman depicted on currency? Answer: The honor belongs to Erisoni II, a Ptolemaic queen of Egypt, who appeared on a coin in the 3rd century BC, says Ellen Feingold, curator of the National Numismatic Collection. Others have included Queen Elizabeth I of England in the 16th century, Indira Gandhi in the 1980s, Maria Montessori in the 1990s, and Eva Peron and Marie Curie in this decade. Women have been far less commonly depicted on U.S. currency. The full roster? Pocahontas and Martha Washington appeared on the bills in the 19th century. Susan B. Anthony and Sacagawea appeared on dollar coins beginning in 1979 and 2000, respectively. And Helen Keller appeared on a quarter issued in 2003. Question: what is considered the first American junk food? Answer: if by junk food you mean mass-produced stuff high in fat or sugar and less than ideal in nutritional value, historians generally look to a sticky mix of popcorn, molasses, and peanuts that made its debut in 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago, says Paula Johnson, a curator at the National Museum of America's History's Division of Work and Industry. By 1896, the two street vendor brothers who invented it, Frederick and Louis Ruckheim, had perfected their recipe and begun advertising their product around the country under the brand name Cracker Jack. The brand is now part of the Frito-Lay snack empire. Question: some Native American names, such as Tohono O'odham, include a mark that looks like an apostrophe. What sound does that mark signify? In the language of the Tohono O'odham, that diacritical mark signifies what linguists call a glottal stop, similar to a hitch you hear in a uh-oh. As Native peoples transferred their spoken languages and dialects into writing over the last 200 years, they used diacritics to indicate inflection, stress, and the timing of pronunciation. In some southern Western languages, Navajo, Apache, Hopi, and Pueblo, among others, you may see such marks below letters. But their meaning varies widely because each nation decided what the marks would signify, says Dennis Zodith, a cultural specialist at the National Museum of the American Indian. Question: who brought the first panda to the United States? Answer: that was Ruth Harkness, a New York City socialite and dress designer, says Lori Thompson, assistant curator at the National Zoo's Giant Panda exhibit. Harkness's husband, William, was organizing an expedition to find a panda in 1936 when he died of throat cancer in Shanghai. She took over. With her guide and porters, Harkness traveled 1,500 miles, mostly by boat and foot, to the mountains separating China from Tibet. After her guide found a male cub in a hollow of a tree, she took it to Shanghai and then to San Francisco. She listed it as a dog on travel forms. Chicago's Brookfield Zoo bought the panda, named Su Lin, in 1937. Harkness returned to China the following year and brought back a female, Mei Mei. The triumph, however, was short-lived. Su Lin died in 1938 and Mei Mei in 1942. If you have questions for the Smithsonian, submit your queries at smithsonian.com/ask. Well, that's all the time we have for today on the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the March edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for listening to Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. So long, until next time.